way back there at the turn of the century, practically, wasn't it rather unusual for a farm boy to go to college?
Well, perhaps.
Well, you had a chance to get a scholarship at some high-powered school back east, didn't you? How did that happen?
Well, I don't know how it happened, honey. I believe it was in the summer of 1907.
Well, that's almost the turn of the century. Well, I didn't miss it far, did I?
I was contacted from some people.
Because you could play football, that was it.
Well, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I was offered a scholarship at the Hotchkiss School.
Where was that?
Well, it was a preparatory school not far from New Haven. It was a finishing school for entrance into Yale University. And it was through perhaps the Department of Athletics at Yale to have me go to Hotchkiss, then come to Yale for the rest of my college work.
Well, why didn't you go?
Well, I left home, bade the folks goodbye with the...
This is 1907 now?
1907.
Oh.
And I was leaving home later than I ordinarily would to go to Emporia to school. But I had to go there to pick up some things.
Well, Skip, what were you going to Emporia for? I mean, what was the attraction at Emporia? Did you know people there?
Why, yes, I'd been in school there 2 years, and I was elected captain of the football team.
Oh, you started in Emporia then in 1905.
That's right.
Oh, I didn't realize this. You got this offer after you had already been in school at Emporia.
Yes, you see this, I'd been taking preparatory work in college. And I was in the regular college, and this offer came to me, and we talked it over with the folks, and they didn't want to see me go away so far, but we agreed that perhaps I should take it. I was to receive my transportation back there, and room and board and books in this, which was recognized as one of the fine Eastern preparatory schools. But when I had to go by Emporia because I'd left some things there that I needed. Upon arrival at Emporia, the kids were all there and they were having football practice, and here was the captain of the football team, and
you just couldn't bear to leave.
I just didn't, but I talked with one of my favorite professors, Jeremiah H. Rhodes. I remember what he told me. He said, "Bill, this is a great thing for you, but if you want to remain in the East and maybe establish your living program there," he says, "I think it would be a fine thing. But on the other hand, your friends are here and your family lives here, and maybe it'd be just as well for you to stay." So I turned down the offer and stayed in Emporia.
You had a struggle to get through school, though, didn't you?
Oh, I guess it would be a struggle perhaps today. I wonder.
You didn't think so at the time, though.
Oh, no.
You know what Ike Eisenhower said? He said, you know, in Abilene, we were poor, but we didn't know it.
Well, we were poor folk, but we didn't know it. We had always had plenty to eat and some of the luxuries, but Dad and Mother worked hard, and they had a large family. They helped me some.
They helped you all they could.
That's right, and they went out of the way to do it. I had no one to offer me a scholarship at Emporia or even get me a job. I waited on tables from a board. I took care of a yard and milked a cow and tended a furnace from a room rent. Later, I carried a laundry route to make some spending money. And Jim, I've often wondered how I ever got through college.
I don't see how you did your studying.
I think maybe they just kind of favored me a little bit.
You worked in the summers.
Yes, I always went home and helped Dad with the harvest and worked on the farm until the summer of 1908. He was getting ready to retire, and he didn't put out as much wheat and crops as he had in previous years. And my roommate in college at that time was a banker's son.
Well, that was Tubby.
Tubby Ford. His name was Fraser, but we called him Tubby because he was a sort of a fat boy, but a wonderful guy. A banker's son from Wauthina, Kansas.
Yeah, he's the one that we saw here about 3 years ago when we went back to Montana.
That's right.
He was up at Lewiston?
Lewistown, Montana.
Took us to the rodeo, the National High School Rodeo.
That's right. And then we took him to Billings, Montana.
I remember what a time we had finding him.
Oh, yes.
We looked all over the state of Montana for him.
Well, any rate, there was a representative of the Underwood and Underwood Company, which at that time were making photographs, and particularly stereoscopic pictures. And
stereoscopic pictures. Those things that you'd put the card in,
right.
Slot, and then you'd look through these lenses, and you saw a three-dimensional depth.
That's right. And they had just completed some pictures, a tour of the Holy Land. And it was quite a historical outlay in pictures of the Holy Land. Well, he convinced us that we could get rich.
This is Tubby.
Selling these things. And Underwood and Underwood had a branch office in Ottawa, Kansas.
Was this the Underwood Typewriter Company?
No, Underwood and Underwood... I guess.
No connection with
that. I don't believe there was, Jen. But at any rate, when school was over, by the way, I didn't even have money to buy this outfit, selling outfit, and any money to get started. Dad sent me $50. And we went to Ottawa, Kansas, and took this salesmanship training course. We were down there, I think, a little over a week. We had a choice of territories. And we selected what we thought would be a nice place to spend the summer in Colorado. Another reason we took the territory was I had been chosen to attend a National YMCA camp in Estes Park. So we went to Colorado, and there was a boy, an Emporia boy, whom he knew quite well, by the name of Alston McCarty, and he had gone out to Denver, Colorado. Incidentally, he was a very good baseball pitcher. He was going to KU, and he was a pitcher on the baseball team, but we played a lot of ball together. And we went out to this YMCA camp, and the territory we chose was Fort Collins, Colorado. Well, Fort Collins, Colorado was a beautiful small town, but when we got out there, we found that the territory thereabouts was mostly of sugar beet cultivation. And the population was mostly Russian.
They weren't interested in your stereoscopic pictures.
No. But we went into Fort Collins and rented a room in a residence. And we started out, not together, but separately, afoot, to make our fortune in selling the stereoscopic travel log of the Holy Land. We went to the preachers and the school people, and we walked in the country. and we'd meet, of course, in the evening back at our living quarters. And somebody'd say, "Bill, how'd you do today?" And I'd say, "Oh, guys, I just did wonderful. This is just the greatest thing."
He probably hadn't sold a thing.
I said, "Hi." Well, he said, "I'm not very well." He said, "I only sold one outfit." Then the next night we'd meet again, and the same rigmarole. He said, "Well, I sold another two." I said, "All right, guys, who are you going to find?" We kept that up all week, and finally Saturday night came, and I came in rather humble that evening. And I said, "Well, tell me, let's get down to some facts here." I said, "How many of these things you sold?" He said, "Well, I sold four." He says, "How many have you sold?" I said, "I haven't sold a damn lot." Well, oh, that was wow. It. We spent our money. I said, "I'll tell you what let's do. Let's hitchhike back down to Denver, and I'll get a hold of Alston McCarty. The racing season is opening, horse racing season." And I said, "Alston has a job out there, and maybe he can get us in." So we hitchhiked back down to Denver, and this is on a Saturday. The races were to open on the following Monday, and we got contact with Alston McCarty, and Tubby being a banker and handling money, Alston McCarty got him a job selling tickets at the entrance. And I, more or less acquainted with horses, he got me a job out in the stable, grooming and taking care of the horses, and sort of a pilot. But lo and behold, when Monday morning came, the governor of Colorado decided that there was too much gambling connected to horse racing, and he closed down the whole program. Well, I said, "Tubby, I'll tell you what we can do. The harvest is just beginning in western Kansas, and let's go back out there and see if we can't get a job." Well, he said, "Anything." So we went down to the Union Station there in Denver. And as we walked in, an old gentleman dressed in farm coveralls came up to us and said, "You boys," he said, "look like pretty stout young fellows." He said, "I'm in here looking for harvest hands." He said, "We need 50 or 100 harvest hands out there in Pawnee County, Kansas." Well, I said, "Here we are. We'll harvest your grain for you." Tubby had never worked there. He didn't know a horse rake from, by guys, a cultivator. But
well, you tried his way, so now he was going to try yours.
So we fooled around there till the next day, and this man's name is an old Kentuckian, the name of McIntyre. And he paid our way back out to Larned, Kansas, and his two boys met us, and he picked up many other harvest hands. But his boys were there to meet us, and we drove 7 miles south of Larned. Little old town down in there called Belfry.
Oh, Belfry, that's still there.
Yes. But this farmer had two sections of wheat. Not a tree in sight. Just two great sections of wheat.
You know, that's hard to understand, because now there are quite a few trees out there.
Oh, yes. Well, much of the territory out there was just virgin prairie with prairie dog colonies, rattlesnakes and screech owls. But at any rate, we started in the next day harvesting. And that was my first experience, Jen, with headers. We had binders and did bundle harvesting down in southeastern Kansas. But this was a headed operation. That is a header. It just took the heads off, and then you...
Heads off the wheat, you mean?
Yes, it took the heads, just put part of the stem and the heads. And then it was stacked in long ricks, two at a setting for the threshermen. Well, Tubby didn't know how to handle a pitchfork at all, but I'd throw off nearly all of it onto the stacker, and then many times it'd throw him off too. About the third day, we'd finished dinner and taken care of the horses, and this old man McIntyre came to me and he said, "Bill," he said, "have you ever stacked a head of grain?" I said, "This is my first experience in harvesting with the header, Mr. McIntyre. But," I said, "I've stacked bundles, I've stacked prairie and clover hay." "Well," he said, "you know, I'm kind of worried about this fellow I've hired as a stacker." "Well," I said, "I've never said anything about it, but I don't think he knows much about it. not looking for his job." Well, we were getting $2.50 a day as the pitchers, but the stackers were getting $3 a day. "Well," he said, "I'm going to let you try it." And so after that, I stacked this head of grain, and Tubby stayed there, and we worked, I think, 22 days in the harvest field with these two sections of wheat. And a few days before we were through with the field harvest, a man by the name of Lou Baker. Now, we worked Sundays right on through. Came over this Sunday evening, and he said to Mr. McIntyre, he said, "How about these two college men you have here? Do you think that they could be good men for me and my thrashing outfit?" And he talked to us, and so we decided to stay out there and work with Lou Baker in thrashing. That's much harder work than the field harvest. So we started in this thrashing business. These ricks, long stacks with an extension feeder. And there were three men on each stack and one down in the pit. And we'd rotate clockwise. One man there, three and down, and then when we were through with the setting, we'd have to throw the belt, hook on the cable, take care of the long self-feeder up to the next setting. We didn't know how to pitch this wheat from the stacks. You just had to, it was skilled. You had to take it off like it was put on. But he'd dig down in there and pull out a few straws. And you know, he only stayed with it 2 days. I remember the first morning after we'd worked all day, he couldn't close his fingers. They were cramped because he had gripped his fork handle too hard. I tried to get him to stay, but he didn't like it. He left in a day or so. But I remained out there in that work. It was a long, hot summer until just a few days before school began. This, by the way, was in the summer of 1908. And I had to go home and get some things. And I stayed until just enough time left to get down to Pittsburgh and the farm there and get my stuff and get back to Emporia. But I think perhaps I'd been out there harvesting about 2 or 3 weeks. There was a Central Kansas Baseball League. And this league was Larned and Great Bend and Ellenwood and Kinsley and Dodge City and those teams in the proximity. And I played some baseball out in there just on a kind of a barnstorming trip. And there's a fellow by the name of Red Harriet who was managing the Larned team. And by the way, he played first base, and I was a first baseman. Or that's where I played. He came out there one evening and said, "Bill, I just learned you were out here." And he says, "We've got a pretty good team," but he said, "I need a second baseman." And he said, "I wish you'd come out." I said, "Well, Red, Dad, I never played second base. You know, I played first." Well, he said, "We'll get that straightened out." He said, I can play second base, and you take over first base." Well, I started in playing baseball every Sunday.
You mean working in the harvest fields all day long and then baseball on Sunday?
That's right. I know a few times we were 8 and 10 miles from morning. But every night out there in that harvest field, by the way, we had a cook shack where the meals were served. And at night we'd pull some straw from the been thrashed out, and just that was where we slept. Just slept on this straw. And that whistle would sound about 4 o'clock in the morning, and away we'd go.
4 o'clock. Oh.
Well, then we'd thrash until dark. Many times it would be 8:30 or close to 9 o'clock. And then I'd walk. That is, I wouldn't go in Saturday night unless we were playing away from home.
But you mean into Larned?
Into Larned, to go with the baseball team. And I'd walk or run this distance in there. And
how far was it?
Well, it varied, depending on where we were thrashing, but it was usually 8 or 10 miles. And sometimes not that much. But if we were playing away from home, I'd go in Saturday night and I slept in a barber shop. And we'd always dress in this barber shop. And but when we played in Larned, the home games on Sunday, I wouldn't go in until Sunday morning. And gosh, when we played at Marysville and at some of these towns were quite a ways, we'd have to leave early in the morning on a tally-ho. And it'd be along sometimes at midnight when we'd get back into Larned. Take a bath, put on my work clothes.
Where'd you take your bath?
How's that?
Where did you take
your
bath?
Well, they had two baths in this barber shop. That's where we always dressed. And then I'd walk on back out to the wheat fields to go to work early Monday morning.
And you kept that up all summer?
Yeah, all summer long. I don't know how I did it, but I did.
Oh, were you in good shape to play football that fall?
No. Well, by the way, the reason I played this baseball, now we were making 20 cents a 100 bushel for in the thrashing crew. And, guys, you'd have to thrash a lot of wheat to make $3 a day.
Well, yeah.
But I got $5 a day on Sunday.
So you really made more playing baseball.
Yeah, I made money on Sunday.